Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Following a spirited debate this week, the New York State Assembly approved a bill to allow undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. It's not a done deal, though, and it faces resistance in the state Senate. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Opponents raised a number of concerns over the measure. Assemblyman Robert Smullen, a Republican from Herkimer and a former Marine, says he worries the licenses could provide a backdoor for criminals and even terrorists to obtain documents for nefarious purposes.
I understand that the chances of a terrorist invading our security measures are slim, and we would desirably want them to be so to not have a repeat of September 11th. But I'm really concerned that we're going to create a new avenue for someone to evade the law and obtain other legal documents.
Assemblywoman Nicole Malliotakis, a Republican from Staten Island, says the state's Association of County Clerks are against the bill because they do not believe they have the technical savvy to verify foreign passports.
Those that slip through the cracks, that are here to try to do us harm, I don't think this bill does enough.
Assemblyman Mark Walczyk of Watertown says he's heard concerns from his local Board of Elections about the possibility of illegal voting if the undocumented immigrants are inadvertently signing up at the DMV to vote.
They don't have the ability to purge those records of non-citizens who may have accidentally just pressed yes on a consumer-forward device or may have checked yes as they're quickly filling out an application, sign the bottom, and now they're registered to vote in the United States of America.
Bill sponsor Marcos Crespo, a Bronx Democrat, says opponents are making an erroneous connection when they link the measure to a potential act of terrorism. And he says he thinks Board of Election staffers are sophisticated enough to catch any errors. He says undocumented immigrants are unlikely to want to vote illegally anyway, because that would be a crime and would subject them to ICE and possible deportation.
I assure you, there is not a single individual in the immigrant community who wants to put themselves at risk of deportation and would not seek to do that.
Supporters of the bill, including Democrat Phil Ramos of Long Island, says the measure will make all New Yorkers safer because undocumented immigrants will learn to drive and buy car insurance. He says states that already have the law have found a drop in hit-and-run accidents because undocumented drivers are no longer tempted to flee the scene of an accident. Ramos, who was formerly a police officer, says the driver's licenses will actually help law enforcement if an undocumented immigrant is involved in a crime because police will have their name and address. He accuses opponents of slicing and dicing the bill to hide what he says is their real reason against it.
We know what it's about. It's about the people who we are giving licenses to. Just say it. I would respect more if it's just said. Some people don't want immigrants to get licensed. They don't want anything given to immigrants to benefit this segment of the community because that segment of the community has been demonized and used politically as a weapon to garner votes.
Assemblywoman Catalina Cruz, a Democrat from Queens who was undocumented when she was a teenager, says her support of the bill has generated hate mail and even death threats. Cruz, whose mother was present for the debate, says her mom had to turn down jobs when Cruz was growing up because she could only work at a job on a subway or bus line.
Pushing our family deeper into poverty. Mommy is now a Head Start teacher, but for years she struggled by taking care of other people's children and cleaning other people's homes. Her inability to drive also meant that she couldn't always be there to witness her hard work come to fruition. When I was in college, I was inducted into the Honor Society, and I stood on stage alone because my mother couldn't attend the ceremony. She wouldn't be able to make it to the ceremony after work using the subway.
The measure faces an uncertain future in the state Senate, where some moderate Democrats have reservations. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, this week, legislative leaders in Albany announced a deal on new tenant protections for millions of New York City apartment dwellers. Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie announced the agreement that includes restrictions on rental increases in rent-stabilized units and authorizes cities throughout the state to create their own rent rules. And the governor said to you this week that he'll sign it.
Well, obviously, it's like going to see a finely tuned dance piece. He knew it was going to happen, obviously. And as I have said, he was sticking them like the picador with the bull and making it so that he would get the credit for having brought them together. They were trying to make common cause so that they would get the credit for doing it. But in the end, there was a huge sigh of relief on the part of people whose houses were protected to some degree, and I mean to some degree, by rent control laws. Now that they had both the Senate and the Assembly, the Democrats, they had to do something, but they couldn't afford to really tick off the upstate communities that didn't want it. So they punted, and they gave the power in upstate communities to do these rent regulations to the individual places. Well, they may end up, and I think they have to some degree in some of the plans, doing the same thing with marijuana. You don't want it, you don't have to have it. Hey, in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, we wanted marijuana reform. You know what? Many places don't in New York, and they're hearing about it, and that's probably one of the reasons why we don't have it in New York State. In any case, folks are coming over the line, giving the tax money and everything else to little Great Barrington. I was in an affair last night for the great Ann Erickson, who was our board member and retiring, and this was her goodbye party. And somebody came up to me and said, boy, there are an awful lot of New York State licenses at the marijuana shop in Great Barrington that's open. And I think sanity prevailed here because the Senate, in the rent control point, has to be wary of protecting their upstate members whose communities may not want this. So it wasn't a slam dunk, and they kept getting prodded by the governor to do something. And he said, I'm going to sign it no matter what they do. And that put tremendous pressure on them and away from him. So it worked out.
Well, one group of people that was not happy with this rent law deal this week, Alan, were the titans of the New York real estate industry. As the New York Times article puts it, they're in, quote, shock.
That was a hell of an article, and I hope everybody reads it, goes to the New York Times and reads about the amount of money that the real estate industry has been putting into our election system. Their number one group that they give money to, of course, were the Senate Republicans, who protected the real estate folks and the lobbyists and all. We had a very good friend named Lester Schulklapper. I always loved the guy, but we never agreed on much. As you may remember, David used to come to my class and say, don't believe any to the kids. Don't believe anything Shattuck ever tells you. However, he was a superb lobbyist for the group. And now the money is drying up because the Democrats are in control. And the Democrats are certainly not helping the landlords here. And now the landlords' organizations are working very hard to try to put a stop to this because there still has to be a vote. And I don't believe they want to see this happening because it's going to make a huge dent in their profits.
Then there's the specter of opening it up to the rest of the state, Alan.
That's right. Now, here's the beauty of the whole Senate thing. As you know, David, the landlords thought they had given so much money to the governor, or the real estate industry thought that they had given so much money to the governor that they would get rewarded for it. But this governor is very canny, and he's saying whatever the legislature passes, I'm doing. And he's done it. So now it looks like he's on the side of the gods. It does appear that this was worked out between the Assembly and the Senate, a bunch of Democrats. But what they needed to do was to handle the upstate question. Look, there are some places where rent controls are needed, others not. So what they've done is to say, up to you. We'll come to each community. You have a vote. You decide whether you're not going to do it or you want to do it. And then that'll be the way it is. Sort of a King Solomon-like splitting of the baby.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The state Senate recently held a public hearing to discuss a bill that would give New Yorkers more control over their personal data online. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports.
State Senator Kevin Thomas introduced a draft of the New York Privacy Act in May. The Democrat from Long Island's 6th District says companies often only disclose the positive aspects of data collection, like package delivery and fraud prevention, while glossing over its more questionable uses. He says sharing and selling data can result in discrimination, differential pricing, and physical harm.
Low-income consumers may get charged more for products online because they live far away from competitive retailers. Health insurance companies could charge higher rates based on your food purchases or information from your fitness tracker. A victim of domestic violence may even have real-time location tracking information sold to their attacker.
The bill would allow New Yorkers to view who is collecting and sharing their personal information, request that it be corrected or deleted, or deny companies the ability to share that information altogether. Staff attorney Lindsay Barrett of the Institute for Public Relations at Georgetown said even seemingly benign public information can be worthwhile to data brokers.
You know, you can take information that by itself seems innocuous, you know, oh, you purchased a pregnancy test here, but then didn't buy diapers a year after, you know, whatever you can get from that, you combine that with publicly available arrest records, driver's records. There's all kinds of publicly available information that can be used in a very privacy-invasive way.
Wired reports the New York Privacy Act largely resembles a bill passed by California last year, the California Consumer Protections Act, or CCPA. But the New York bill would allow individual residents to sue any business they feel violated their privacy. Tech NYC's Zachary Hecht opposes the concept, saying the bill needs to narrow its definitions of harm faced by consumers.
Inconvenience of time, you have alters the individual's experiences. That's less clear what we're talking about there. And if we're talking about the deliverance of ads and things of that nature, there are free speech concerns and commercial speech concerns there, and we have to be very careful with how we go through those definitions.
Hecht also takes issue with the bill's concept of data fiduciaries. As data fiduciaries, Thomas says businesses would not be allowed to benefit from data use at the detriment of the consumer. They'd have to put privacy before profits. And Hecht said that complicates things for businesses.
Publicly traded companies have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders. So would this new fiduciary responsibility supersede that? How would those work together? And then the way that the data fiduciary is described here is quite broad. A lot of the legal work that talks about data fiduciary says that in certain contexts it needs to be narrowly framed, and this is very broad.
Unlike the CCPA, which only applies to companies making more than $25 million a year, the New York Protection Act would apply to all businesses. Critics claim data regulation escalates costs, stifles innovation, and burdens small businesses. Professor Ari Ezra Waldman from New York Law School said he's never seen evidence to that end, and that critics are missing the point.
It's not necessarily better that a company is smaller. Two guys in a garage can invade our privacy just as insidiously as a 40,000-person company. The focus should be on not the size of the company, but in the purpose of regulation. Regulation has the capacity to actually inspire innovation.
Those in favor of increased regulation also came with suggestions for the bill. Mary Ross of MSR Strategies, who worked on the CCPA, warned against using specific market-based definitions of harm and suggested Thomas expand a provision allowing people to opt out of sharing their data.
In the California law, we allow a third party to opt out on a person's behalf. There's so many companies out there that are collecting, processing, and selling your personal information. And an individual has no idea who these companies are. So it would be great, speaking of another business opportunity or a nonprofit opportunity, to allow other people or organizations to be able to opt out of the sale of your information on your behalf.
Ari Ezra Waldman from New York Law School said he would like to see the bill make room for the concept of privacy by design, where companies create their products with privacy in mind, but says in general the act is a good start.
Sure, we can educate, we can put it in curriculum in schools, we can have campaigns about it, but that's not the goal. We have to shift the burden to companies and provide regulation that limits what they can collect because we are cognitively unable, even with all possible information, to make those adequate choices.
Senator Thomas says he would like to see the bill ASAP, but time is of the essence. The 2019 legislative session ends June 19th. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
Another county in New York is close to banning styrofoam packaging for takeout food. The Westchester Board of Legislators voted unanimously late last week to regulate the use of polystyrene foam containers. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
The measure will eliminate the sale or use of expanded polystyrene coffee cups, as well as other EPS containers and utensils commonly used for takeout and prepared foods, and for restaurant leftovers. Bill co-sponsor Kitley Coville brought evidence of polystyrene litter to the meeting, pointing to items such as foam packing peanuts she found around her in just a few minutes waiting to meet someone.
And this is what I found. This, and this, and this, and peanuts, and broken little pieces of styrofoam. And they're disgusting. And although we heard people say that they're recyclable, people actually don't recycle them. They throw them out of their car.
Coville, a Democrat, represents some northern Westchester communities, such as Bedford, Mount Kisco, and North Salem.
We are drowning in plastic, and we are seeing our, particularly our mammals, wash up on the shore full of plastic.
We know that styrofoam is a big source of neighborhood litter. It's hazardous to marine life. It clogs our waste streams and pollutes our waterways. And we really have concerns about its impact on marine life and our beaches.
That's Julie Tai, president of the New York League of Conservation Voters.
I think one of our priorities at the League is really looking at waste management in general and trying to reduce the amount of waste that we're generating in the first place. Westchester, assuming that this becomes law, will be joining many other parts of New York, including New York City, Albany County, Nassau County, and Suffolk County that have already banned its use, and many other cities across the country.
The new measure prohibits EPS food containers to be used by vendors in restaurants or sold in stores. It also prohibits the sale of loose-fill EPS packing foam in Westchester. Pre-packaged food that arrives sealed in EPS packaging, as well as packaging for raw eggs and butcher case packaging, are exempted. Kristen Anderson is a member of the Larchmont Environmental Committee. She thanked legislators for their legislation, but had a request about that exemption ahead of the vote.
California's ban on expanded polystyrene does not exempt prepackaging. New York should not exempt expanded polystyrene either when it comes to packaging. Please pass the expanded polystyrene ban without a prepackaging exemption.
She acknowledges there could be a cost to businesses for this, but it is a cost worth stemming pollution. Ann Jaffe Holmes, program director of the Federated Conservationists of Westchester County, says the legislation moves towards celebrating, honoring, and valuing diversity among people and the natural world.
An expanded polystyrene is one of those materials that when you watch a bird or a fish eat it, or you see it clogging up the waterways, you know you're not honoring other species or the rest of the world.
Legislator Nancy Barr is one of the bill's co-sponsors and chair of the board's Environment, Health, and Energy Committee. She calls the measure a good first step.
I hope that this is the first of many environmental resolutions and laws that we will be passing in this legislature.
Riverkeeper, which conducts an annual spring cleanup along the shorelines of the Hudson Valley and New York City, frequently removed polystyrene and other plastic.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government, politics. I'm David Gustina. Every year, the North Country Chamber of Commerce hosts a business expo, gathering representatives across industrial sectors in Plattsburgh to network and discuss issues. During this year's event, the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley asked exhibitors about cross-border trade and whether they had concerns about ratification of the USMCA, known as the new NAFTA.
Nearly 200 businesses displayed wares and services at SUNY Plattsburgh's Fieldhouse as people stopped to chat, learn about their work, and grab some swag. North Country Chamber Vice President of Economic Development Susan Matten says most businesses in the region are involved with cross-border trade in some form. While the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA Trade Pact, has not been ratified by the U.S. or Canadian governments, She says there appears to be heightened business confidence in the wake of the elimination of steel and aluminum tariffs affecting Canada.
Most people have now that the Canadian steel issue got settled. I think there's a little more optimism than there had been about whether this will get settled in the near future. We don't, any of us know, of course, but we did a seminar last week for Canadian companies, and 26 of them decided to come down and see us and explore the opportunity, which we saw as a positive sign of people starting to feel a little better about the situation.
CDC Real Estate only deals with commercial and industrial properties and specializes in aiding Canadian companies as they enter the U.S. Owner and president Matt Boyer, who was taking a break outside the venue, says there's a lot of cross-border activity from support vendors and suppliers for larger manufacturers.
That's the good news. The bad news is we actually don't have a great deal of warehouse space right now, but there's more new stuff being built. You know, it's been good. I mean, I know there's been a lot with our concerns over NAFTA and some of the tariffs, and that's made it a little bit bumpy for us. But yet our phone's still ringing. I think some Canadian companies actually consider that as a bit of a warning sign and say maybe we ought to just set up our own U.S. subsidiary so that we don't have to deal with that issue in the future.
Boyer adds that they have participated in workshops with the local and Montreal chambers, and the unratified trade agreement remains an underlying issue.
There's no doubt that many companies right now are very concerned about all that and where is it going. The uncertainty definitely doesn't help. I think we'd all be a lot better off if either it had not probably been touched or if it at least had been completed and the new one was in effect and that you know, people would understand what they're dealing with. So I think the uncertainty definitely affects us. But yet again, the phone keeps ringing and we keep talking to new companies. And CDC, you know, we've been fortunate. I mean, we're working, we hate to do this, but we're working with some companies in Vermont and even the Albany region right now because they need to find suitable space and they have some U.S. contracts and U.S. content requirements.
The Development Corporation is a nonprofit organization that provides industrial space for businesses. President and CEO David F. Champagne III calls current cross-border business strong.
Obviously, with the NAFTA rewriting has had an impact. I think it probably slowed it down for a little while with the uncertainty. But now with that behind us, I think a little, it is coming back. We have a lot of interest in our parks. I say business is strong across the border.
The North Country Chamber has actively lobbied for the ratification of the USMCA. In late May, it led a group of regional business owners and Quebec government representatives who traveled to Washington to advocate for the agreement. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
The Albany Pine Bush Preserve in New York's capital city is home to a rare type of butterfly called the Karner Blue. But the unique landscape is also home to a species that the federal government wants to know more about. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard explains.
Inside the Truax Barrens at the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, Conservation Director Neil Gifford stands on a sandy path. Looking across a green, brushy landscape, there are scrub oak plants about a yard tall and scraggly-looking pitch pines. One of the largest scrub oak pine barrens in the country, Gifford says the area is home to a variety of animal species.
Prairie warblers, indigo buntings, brown thrashers, and a number of reptiles and amphibians like spotted turtles, box turtles, spadefoot toad, which is a desert toad.
And of course, the Karner Blue butterfly. A tiny cerulean flyer comes in for a landing.
Is it a he or
it's a he?
It's a he. And he's hanging out right on the cuff of my jeans on my boot right now.
The adult female Karner Blue lays its eggs on a plant called Wild Blue Lupin. It's also the only plant its caterpillars eat. Here, in early June, blue patches of lupin flowers stand out amid the green scrub. In the distance, there's a plume of smoke as workers with the Pine Bush Preserve Commission start a prescribed fire. Gifford says without the fires, the landscape and its wild blue lupin cannot remain.
Fire has been on this landscape in ecological time for tens of thousands of years. And this site has existed as a pitch pine scrub oak barrens for thousands and thousands of years as a result of that recurring, relatively frequent wildland fire.
Thanks to the Pinebush Preserve Commission's work, the Karner Blue's population was declared recovered 4 years ago. But we're also on the lookout for another rare species, the frosted elfin, a small brown butterfly. Gifford explains that both species make use of different parts of the wild blue lupin plant, a plant which has seed pods similar to peas.
As the pods develop, the threatened frosted elfin butterfly lays its eggs on the pods, and that's how the two species, Karner Blues and frosted elfin, share the same resource or the same plant. One feeds exclusively as a caterpillar on the seed pods, the other eats principally the leaves.
While both species emerge with the lupin in the spring, we didn't see any frosted elfins on this day. It's a little late in their flight season. The adults only live about 2 or 3 weeks. But places like the Pinebush Preserve are instrumental in understanding more about the species. Today, the federal government is looking to understand more about the frosted elfin in particular. Robin Niver is a conservation biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
So enough states had identified this as a species of concern that it came to our radar, came on our radar as, oh, you know, how is this species doing? Is it a species we should also be worried about kind of at the federal level?
The Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that the condition of nearly 90% of frosted elfin populations across the eastern U.S. is unknown. Historically, the frosted elfin, which relies on wild blue lupin and another plant, wild indigo, ranged from the northeast down to Florida and across to the Midwest. A decision is expected in 2023 on the federal status of the frosted elfin. So areas like the Pinebush, where biologists work to preserve shrinking habitat and engage the public, are important.
Most federally listed species are on private lands, especially in the east where we don't have a lot of public lands. So having public interest and excitement and support for rare species is essential.
For photos, flap on over to WAMC.org. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1924. Or just listen to our podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina.